Hello, and welcome to the ACE Pod 1.10, sponsored by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. This week we are coming off a supremely ugly 10-3 win over Iowa. That is still at least a win. At least that's what we're going to keep telling ourselves, because closer examination of anything other than the defense can be a bit of a bummer. But we're going to be doing a little bit of that anyway. And once again, doing the mailbag thing, splitting it up again this week between emails and Twitter. So this will be the longer stuff, starting with the email questions. And starting with one from Steven that kind of fits the vibe. Has the collective Michigan fan base slash you ever felt worse about a win against a top 15 opponent in which they covered? I think the short answer is no. I think part of a lot of this is that I don't think many people out there really feel like Iowa is a top 15 team. They have played absolute dregs so far this season, including two teams Michigan has faced and handled easily. And the only decent team they've faced before was Iowa State, which was just an absolutely hideous game. So it's just, and it was road Iowa. It was not Kinnick, Iowa. They're down to 21st in SP Plus at this point. And yes, while Michigan did cover, that line got bet way down, both from where it was in the preseason and also from where it opened. the other part of this is that there just aren't that many wins over top 15 teams that are this ugly and don't feel good. And of late, there aren't that many wins over top 15 teams, period. So it's hard to think of a worse one, in large part because we're just working from a relatively small sample here. That said, I understand why people don't particularly feel good after this game, other than the defense and maybe getting some optimism at defensive tackle. There wasn't much about this that really changed the season outlook beyond having that chalked up as a win versus a loss, which will look nice at the end of season record, but I don't know, in terms of predicting how the rest of the season goes, whether that really changed a whole lot. Next question. Hey, Ace. Alex here, back for another question this week. Based on what you have seen of the team so far this season, would you be content with a loss to just OSU and a decent bowl win, or is it still beat OSU or bust? I think you have to keep your expectations kind of as a living thing as you move throughout the season. And based on what I've seen so far, getting a win against Ohio State would be friggin' incredible. In terms of whether I would be content with the season, I'm just looking for some improvement out of the offense at this point, something that may indicate that they didn't just take a year where they had 9 returning starters and a 5-star coming in at running back and light it on fire. Because that's kind of how it feels like right now. And I think the sights have turned from OSU more to like, hey, let's make sure we're still ahead of where Michigan State is at. And that is very much up in the air right now. And let's see if we can find an identity, because right now there really is none on offense. So I'll be content if Michigan beats Michigan State and looks like they've got something that they're putting together for the next year. A win with Ohio State would make me much, much more than content, pretty much no matter what happened before that, just to experience that. But if your expectations are there, it is time to dial it down a little bit. All right, the next one's from Doug. My question is about Don Brown. After reading Seth's Next Sharpies post today, I'm tempted to say that Don Brown is a genius, or at least an elite defensive coordinator. But then, Brown's defense gave up 62 points against Ohio State last November, and people were calling for him to be fired. What's the truth here? He can't be a genius one week and a has-been the next. Well, I mean, that's true. He can't be a genius one week and a has-been the next. And one of those is a bit of an overreaction. And the other one has a really strong track record behind it. I do think Don Brown has faced some more challenges than we maybe anticipated in stepping up to this level, where now, instead of kind of flying under the radar at a UConn or a Boston College, where you don't have teams kind of looking out and installing some prep for you all season, they might be taking you a bit lightly. In this case, he doesn't get to hide behind that. He's also going against better coaches in a better league. And we have seen opposing coaches take advantage of the fact that, you know, he's very dedicated to press man. There are some things he gets locked into. He's hasn't always quite necessarily maximized personnel usage in his time at Michigan. At the same time, you know, Michigan's been a top five defense pretty much every year he's been here. So it's really difficult to, I mean, I don't like throwing around the genius term for coaches, but he's one of those guys who I think is at that level above, to take a familiar example, like a Rich Rodriguez scheme guy, where he kind of figured out one thing and built a career off of that, but didn't necessarily evolve a ton from there. Don Brown has evolved at every stop, and we saw this past week how much more he leaned on zones, how he was able to put his guys in really good position to make plays on those crossing routes that, you know, were the big reason why Michigan gave up 62 points against Ohio State last year. So, I mean, I don't like throwing out the genius term, but is he an extremely good defensive coordinator? Yes. Is Michigan lucky to have him? Yes. Would Michigan be able to do better if they tried the open market? Highly unlikely. I understand the people who flinched a little bit after seeing crossing routes now after what happened against Ohio State, but I would also be very surprised if we got a repeat of that this year. All right, next one is from Greg. What is the way forward for the offense in the big picture? Do we part with Gattis at season's end and start over? Pray that the backup QB is the solution. It's like circa 2017. Hold steady. Would love to hear your thoughts on this one. I mean, ideally, you see enough progression from Gattis that there is reason to think that an extra year will provide more than what you'd get from undergoing another offensive turnover. What worries me is that with how little Gattis has shown so far, that is really putting another season at risk. But so is bringing in a new guy. So, I mean, unless you've got a real home run type hire potentially on hand, somebody who has proven to be a good offensive coordinator at this level, then I think you probably roll with Gattis, hope that Shea Patterson was a big part of the problem this year, and move forward. You got to kind of grit your teeth while looking at that, but we'll also have a much better idea by season's end how much Gattis is willing and able to evolve, how much of these issues may have actually been on Shea Patterson, whether Dylan McCaffrey is potentially the answer. We are hopefully going to have a lot more info to work off of than a couple of Big Ten games, one of which was against Rutgers, and a very strange first couple non-conference games. So we'll see where that goes. I think you have to take a wait-and-see approach at this point. But unfortunately, if there were a situation to kind of Nussmeier a guy, I mean, Nussmeier obviously went out with the entire rest of the coaching staff. But Gattis' performance this year, given what he was handed, is really alarming. And there is justified discussion over his job status. Next question comes from Daniel. And thankfully is switching things up a little bit. If you could take one player from the past 30-ish years, i.e. more or less in our lifetimes, of Michigan football and put him on this team, who would it be? Maybe do a QB and a non-QB, because at this point I feel like the right answer is a QB. Indeed. My answer, quarterback. I would love to see 2012 slash early 2013 Devin Gardner on this team. Denard would be a close second, but I would love Gardner's combination of his throwing ability and running ability for what this offense is supposed to be. Non-QB, finding it hard to look past a DT. I think I would go with Ryan Glasgow, but Mo Hurst or Mike Martin would be close second slash third choices. I think Glasgow edges it with his down-to-down ability and range. Hard to pass up someone like Charles Woodson, but I feel like you get more of an upgrade with an elite DT. I wouldn't hugely quibble with those choices from Daniel, but I think we can do better. Although I will say, with the quarterback answer, if you can get the 2013 version of Devin Gardner that went against OSU without the broken foot. If you can take a single game guy, that's the guy for this offense. I'm looking more at full seasons for this exercise. And unfortunately, that kind of puts a big hit on both Gardner, obviously, who had a big chunk of 2013 where the offensive line and the offense itself had just kind of broken him. And he only played, a few games at the end of 2012 at quarterback. And Denard, his seasons would start strong and less strong, at least in the passing regard. So for me, the biggest problem that I see right now, I think Michigan's foregone the quarterback running game, taken out a lot of the reads already, and we could still see them with a functional offense without that, but you need a much better performance in the passing game, and especially the downfield passing game. And for that, I want 2006 Chad Henne, his junior year, where he put up nearly a full yard better on yards per attempt than he did in the better remembered 2004 season. And this was without working with Braylon Edwards. He did have Mario Manningham, but Braylon was a pretty unbelievable downfield threat. Henne also posted better touchdown and interception rates that season than he did when he was a freshman. I would have loved to have seen how the senior version of Chad Henne would have worked out, but unfortunately he was too injured throughout that season to be able to pick him here. So 2006 Chad Henne is my choice. And actually, the more I think about it, 2000 Drew Henson would also very much be in the running, because you could keep that quarterback run game very much a factor, while also having somebody who could really throw the ball all over the field. So actually, I've changed my answer. It's 2000 Drew Henson, a guy who was looking like he was going to be a Heisman candidate before the Steinbrenner stepped in, unfortunately. All right, next one comes from Mike. Pretty random question, but I've always had this discussion with my dad about who are the best Michigan players that just look the best or coolest in their uniform. A few guys I've loved were Donovan Warren, Adrian Arrington, and Brandon Miner. I find those all to be very strong choices. Honestly, Ambry is making a case this year. Thanks, Mike. Ambry is a good jumping off point, Ambry Thomas, because I think there's something about that number one jersey that just looks extremely cool no matter what. So that two of the guys that instantly came to mind, three. Anthony Carter was the original. And then in my lifetime, David Terrell and Braylon Edwards both made that number one uniform look pretty awesome. Charles Woodson, especially when he had the visor, the dark visor, in the Rose Bowl against Washington State. Tough to get much cooler than that, especially when you combine it with his on-field performance. I always like my first memory, my earliest memories of Michigan football were in 1994, and obviously the dude at that time was Ty Wheatley. And the fact that a guy that big who could fill out a uniform like that, move that fast, always stood out to me. I thought he really those 90s uniforms weren't great for like making you look cool because they hung loose. They did they just weren't they looked kind of sloppy. Like 80s and 90s uniforms, they've really tightened things up over the last like 10, 20 years. So I think the modern guys do kind of look cooler. A couple more of those guys in that regard. Sean Crable, just because he had such an unusual body type, and the single digit number coming off the edge. I love the single digit numbers on defensive linemen. I think that looks cool. So Rashawn Gary also gets a shout out here. And then finally, Taco Charlton, for some reason, just 33 on a defensive end. I thought was pretty sweet. And he also was a first off the bus type. He definitely filled out his uniform. So Taco, plus he got the name too. So a lot of cool points for him. So those are a few. Brandon Miner, I thought was a great choice. Adrian Arrington too, from the initial email. And to be honest, I mean, it's hard not to look good in a Michigan uniform, right? All right, next question comes from Jason. If you're inviting Hoops recruits to Ann Arbor to see a game, which game are you bringing them to between now and the end of the year? I suspect it has to be a football game, right? We play Notre Dame, MSU, OSU, all huge rivalries. We are most likely to win MSU, but that's also the game most likely to be extremely annoying. OSU is very likely to be an epic blowout, but it's also the game. I guess I would pick ND because history says that really exciting things happen in Michigan ND games. I suspect that win or lose, exciting is good for recruiting. That is the case, and I would pick Ohio or I would pick Notre Dame for this game, but that's not really necessarily the reason why I would center a basketball recruiting weekend on that game. First of all, you're going to be outside. It's Michigan, so weather's going to play a factor. Even for basketball players, you want to show them campus at the time when you can spend the most time walking around campus. And Notre Dame's in October. It's in mid-October. It is not in November like Michigan State or late November like Ohio State. Also, they don't care as much about the outcome of that. Hoops recruits won't care about as much about the outcome of a football game. So, I mean, Notre Dame might be a tougher game than Michigan State, although I don't necessarily know if I buy into that. But I don't think it matters if you're looking at trying to pick a win here. I'd mostly just pick get these guys in early. You want to jumpstart recruiting, especially right now. Get those guys in when you can. Get them in when it's as warm as it can possibly be. And pray to the weather gods that they agree with you. And then, other than that, I don't think it matters too much with basketball recruiting. You're going to be spending a lot of your time at the practice facility and, maybe in the film room with Juwan Howard, kind of seeing how you're going to be used, working with the assistant coaches, meeting the other players. So hopefully, the football specific aspects of this do not matter too much. And we're going to end the email portion on a fun off-topic question from Daniel. I recently fired up an emulator on my computer and brought out my old NCAA 2004 disc and have been playing it for a little bit. If you could only play one version of NCAA, which one would it be? For me, hard to look past NCAA 2004. The gameplay is the best the series had for a couple of years. 2005 was unplayable. Obviously, the games are better and more complex with later versions, but 2004 is also the one I probably played the most. It holds up fairly well, to be honest, although I haven't picked up a new football game since 2012 or so. Bring back the NCAA series, Daniel. Agree with you on bringing it back. Let's get those players paid and get that video game dropped. For me, I kind of want a mixture of a couple games because at this point, I don't think you can. I wouldn't want to play an NCAA game that didn't have the read option in the game as something that you could run. And I don't think that came in until the last couple iterations of the game. The last one was 2014. So I'd want that. But what I do miss is something that they broke out in the previous, PS2 generation of and the original Xbox generation. It did not make the port over to the PS3 slash 360 for what should be obvious reasons, but in like 2007 and 2008, they introduced player misconduct and having to like divvy up points between recruiting and progression and discipline. You could choose what level of suspensions to give players who committed off-field infractions. I think it was usually like, I think they just say like nebulous player misconduct stuff, or they might have had academics as a thing. I don't think they had like your guy got arrested, or that you were specifically cheating to pay players. They wouldn't let you do that. But you could get NCAA sanctions. There was like an NCAA interest bar if you just decided to go totally lax on the player discipline. And it's a thing that the NCAA would never agree to now, but it did provide kind of a silly, fun aspect to Dynasty to kind of switch things up. And it was always interesting to see how much you could get away with trying to be SMU before you'd almost inevitably get caught. So, unfortunately, the thing I want back is a thing that is almost certainly not coming back, but the real thing we all want back is the game itself. And it does seem like we are taking some major steps in that direction. So hopefully it won't be too much longer. With that, gonna take a quick break and we'll turn it over to your Twitter questions.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters in venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
All right, we are back with your Twitter questions, and we got a lot this week, so I'm going to try to get through these with a relative alacrity. First is from at NaptownJazz12. Will you ever be able to believe anything said in the off-season ever again? If so, what are you going to use as your bullshit detector? This is an extremely good question. It's becoming more and more difficult to believe a lot of the positive stuff that comes out during the off season, and you have to become kind of either kind of just gotta ignore all of it, unless there's something that is so full-throated from every corner that it's tough to ignore. For instance, people have been talking up Nico Collins pretty constantly, and he wasn't a guy that had to be talked up given the amount of talent at receiver, but you get enough guys going, holy crap, this guy's unguardable. And that becomes something that you can maybe, that you can build off of. When you're getting promised certain wide-ranging schematic changes, or you're getting told that players at positions that really need somebody to step up are in fact stepping up, a lot of that is getting quotes out there, you know, either to provide motivation or reassurance, or there's a lot of communicating from coaches to players through the media that happens, with the messages that they send or don't send through that medium. I will say the one piece of off-season intel that I feel like was definitely true was that Shea Patterson was spending a lot of time on the golf course. So it sounds funny, but those are the things that I think you kind of do need to pay attention to, is when a coach occasionally kind of lets something slip where you're like, huh. And that was one of those moments where it was like, he didn't necessarily need to say that. He kind of pulled back on it pretty quickly, but there was, you know, something caused him to say that. And now it's pretty easy to see that it was probably some frustration with how hard his presumed starting quarterback was working on getting down the offense during the offseason, as opposed to, you know, getting out there and enjoying himself on the links. So I don't know. I mean, in general, I've always been pretty skeptical of off-season talk, and more try to look at what a player did the previous year and kind of just what you can generally expect heading into the next year based on kind of their general player profile, and instead of what some insiders might have caught. Because the other thing you get is, you might be getting a word from an insider, but that insider might have caught 30 minutes of one practice. And, I mean, players' performances can vary wildly from practice to practice. They can also vary wildly within a single practice. You're working with a small sample. It's just, the off-season stuff is really hard, especially to rely on, especially with how much they've shut things down. So, I don't know. You kind of got to go with your own gut, but for me, it's gonna take a lot, and most of the stuff I'm looking at is gonna be kind of concerning between the lines stuff. I'm sure there will be a very healthy amount of skepticism about any off-season reports next year. All right, this one is from @ColinTJ. Do most people really want the generic pro sports stadium experience that you in football/hockey are increasingly indistinguishable from? What's actually driving that change? I don't think this is what people want. I think people are in large part responding to it by not showing up as much. I don't think there's any question across college football and also at Michigan that they are not packing that place in like they used to. You can say what you will about students packing their way down and whatever, but there did not used to be like a healthy swath of seats up top that you could identify. And I think a lot of that, obviously at Michigan, some of that comes down to the quality of the program, but the program's been pretty darn good the last few years. So if you can't pack that stadium then, it's really, I think that still speaks to the stadium experience getting worse. I assume this is, I wish I knew what was driving it other than like a bunch of, I don't know, Dave Brandon acolytes thinking that this is what everybody wants because it's profitable at the professional level. And it's disappointing. I think it takes away from the game day atmosphere. I mean, I know I wasn't there this year, but apparently this was the first homecoming in a long, long time where we did not get the Temptation Hawaiian War Chant inclusion in the halftime show, as is a very wonderful tradition. And it seems like the alumni band was kind of de-emphasized in general, which is also disappointing. That's the kind of stuff that for me growing up, that's the stuff that makes you connect to a place. And I don't know. I mean, there are still things about Michigan Stadium that you're obviously going to connect to. There are very few feelings like walking into one of the entrances and seeing the better part of 100,000 seats unfold below you. I think that's one of the coolest things I've experienced in all sports. But the other stuff that I tie in mostly to the stadium experience growing up is like hearing a few members of the band pop into my section and play the Rocky and Bullwinkle theme song. And, you know, on homecoming, having the alumni cheerleaders doing flips off the railing and juggling swords and lighting stuff on fire. And, you know, maybe they're not allowed to do quite all of that stuff anymore, but it does feel like a lot of what you connect to has been taken away. And I think there are ways that they could use technology and use the video board to help people have a better stadium experience. I mean, some of the videos that they produce for commercial breaks have been really cool, and I think they could do more of that. But I think also we just want to hear more of the band, and it's okay to not be assaulted by noise all the time. And I don't think I'm saying that just to somebody who's got an illness that makes him sound sensitive. There have been times, I mean, I've had trouble at basketball games just being able to focus and not feel drained from just the sheer amount of just kind of the assault by noise that you get there. And that's less of a problem at the football stadium, obviously, but you do get that with hockey when they pump in music. You know, it's a small indoor arena. And football, I mean, they'll still play music loud enough where, I mean, you might have to raise your voice when you're talking to the person next to you. And during a commercial break, sometimes it's nice to really just have a quiet break. And I don't know, the pumped in music, which I think is okay in doses, especially if you are using it for trolling purposes. But, I do find the experience to be a lot more generic than it was when I was growing up. And I think long term we're going to see Michigan being in the same boat as a lot of pretty much the rest of sports, really, in terms of how do you make the in-person experience distinguishable from and preferable to watching the game on television. And I don't think it's by assaulting people with noise. I think it's by doing the stuff that you can only find at the stadium, like the band, and emphasizing that kind of stuff. So hopefully there's a change in direction, because, you know, the hope was that maybe that was just a Dave Brandon thing, but it's lingered. Next question is from at Out of the Gates. Do we owe Pep Hamilton an apology? Nope, I don't think so. He made a decent amount of money to coach an underwhelming offense. Just because the offense is still underwhelming doesn't mean we need to do revisionist history on a guy who could not get tossed to a job higher up than the XFL. That would be some serious revisionist history. From at Jeep and Ben, what did the D do differently than against Wisconsin to have success? And what did the offense do that worked against Rutgers that they didn't do against Iowa? The latter question is the easy one to answer, which is they didn't go against Rutgers. I'm not sure that there's much of a change otherwise. There wasn't major schematic stuff. I mean, yeah, going against Rutgers is, you know, the salve that heals all wounds. And it does not really move the needle on how good the offense actually is. So, I mean, we did see some play calling stuff that looked like it may have been a little promising in terms of, we saw like a wide receiver screen and they were throwing the ball downfield a little bit, but we still saw a limited running game against Rutgers, and that carried over to Iowa. It was not just shoving the quarterback run game to keep the quarterback healthy. There's just not a quarterback run game right now. And then it's a matter of whether they want to throw the ball downfield. And to Josh Gattis's credit, he is getting some receivers open downfield. Patterson just is not getting the ball to them. I don't think either of them are doing a great job, but that is one thing that Gattis should get at least a little bit of credit for. As for what the defense did differently against Iowa versus Wisconsin, First of all, I think there's a pretty significant downgrade on Iowa's interior line versus Wisconsin, which makes a pretty big difference, and you're not going against Jonathan Taylor. That said, I think the return of Mike Dwumfor was pretty big just in terms of both the fact that he was out there, able to play, and from what I saw, looked pretty solid in terms of holding up on the interior, making the occasional slash in the backfield. I thought he had a pretty promising full game back, and that wasn't just important for having solid play against the run with a quality DT. It let Michigan just run more packages because you're not necessarily forced into running a 3-3 stack if you don't want, you know, Ben Mason or a freshman out there. So it was really nice to see Dwumfor in there playing well, I thought. I mean, we'll see what the full review of the tape reveals, but I thought this was a promising start for him, and just having some more meat up front, I think, made a significant difference. And the other thing is something we touched on in the first half of this podcast and that Seth wrote about in his post today, which is, you know, Don Brown showing a willingness to throw some change-ups. They've gone to a lot more zone, and they're emphasizing, you know, holding down those crossing routes. And other than a couple issues that were more on player mistakes than the play calls, they did a great job of that against the Hawkeyes. So I think the reinsertion of Dwumfor and a little bit more variety in the scheme was quite helpful. And also, I think Wisconsin's a significantly better team than Iowa, unfortunately, at least for projection purposes. All right, next question is from @RichardWWatkins. If McCaffrey can't go for Illinois, should Joe Milton be given some run at QB? How much time should he play, and should it be before the game has been decided? I'm really hoping this game gets decided quickly, and with Shea Patterson looking at least functional, because Illinois is not very good. So he should be able to have a bounce-back game against them, and I don't think that's necessarily going to tell us much. Instead, if McCaffrey's not ready to go, I think you have to give Joe Milton some running in this game. Ideally, you'd just have the opportunity to do it naturally as Michigan builds enough of a lead where you can just kind of turn the game over to him. Whether they put him in earlier than that, I don't know. Both because I don't know if Michigan's necessarily in a position where they can waste possessions in a competitive game. And while I'm not saying putting in Joe Milton would necessarily waste a possession, especially if he shows that he can actually execute a quarterback run game and that they have one installed, he was a guy who was supposed to take a long time. What we've seen of him, he has an exceptionally strong arm, but it does seem like he is still dialing it in a bit. And, you know, he has been the third quarterback, and the first two haven't, you know, blown us out of the water exactly. So it'd be a bit of a desperation move, but it's starting to reach that point. So I think a lot of it would be determined by how that game is going and how Patterson is playing. But if you get a comfortable lead, I think you got to throw him in there and see what you get. And if the offense sputters, you may have to do that anyway. In a related question, from @_Keeltyka, going forward, do you still see Shea as the starter, or do you think Dylan gets the job as soon as he's healthy? I'm afraid Dylan will come back and be nervous / jittery after taking that big hit. It gets complicated from here because I don't think they're just going to hand McCaffrey the job. I think it's going to be kind of a back and forth competition a little bit. And we're just running out of, especially if McCaffrey is not available for this game, which is really the last kind of cupcake game Michigan has on its schedule, depending on how you feel about Maryland. There's not a great spot to just turn the offense over to a first-time starter. So, or you're going to have to wait until the bye week between Maryland and Michigan State. But by that point, you'll have already had really critical games. I mean, Notre Dame is not so critical for obviously it's not critical at all for Big Ten purposes. It is critical for feelings ball purposes, I think. At Penn State is obviously a big game where you want to have things decided there. And then at Maryland, you know, their offense has shown the capability of being explosive. I do think Michigan should still win that game comfortably, but thought that about some other games this season too. It's tough. They're going to have to kind of thread a needle here. A lot of it's going to have to do with how quickly McCaffrey is able to return from what was a pretty scary-looking concussion. You do not want to rush those at all. So we'll see. And you don't know how McCaffrey's going to react to, being open to live hits after taking such a nasty one until you see him in live action on a football field. So, the only way where you really are going to find that out is to put him back in there. I don't know if Patterson is going, or if Patterson's going to give up the job as soon as McCaffrey's healthy, but I do think McCaffrey's going to get on the field in some capacity as soon as he's healthy. And unless Patterson really turns it around, I think we're all hoping that McCaffrey ends up taking that job away. Speaking of taking jobs away, from our friend Jamie Mack at Jess Cover Blog. Where and how often does Josh Ross play when he's healthy? That is a very good question, because I get the feeling Michigan is not going to want to take Cam McGrone off the field. And I think the ideal setup there is to keep McGrone at middle linebacker, the spot that he's worked at the most, where he's clearly quite comfortable, and where he can be a real menace on those interior blitzes. And obviously, we saw Josh Ross play and play quite well as the starting weak side linebacker last year. So I think you throw him in there in a competition with Jordan Glasgow potentially and see kind of who emerges from there, or if maybe you rotate those guys depending on what your needs are out there. Because I think Glasgow's a little bit better of a blitzer, but Ross, is able to hold up better against offensive linemen in the run game. So we'll see. Obviously, Cam McGrone's emergence is very exciting for a lot of reasons, and I think one of them is that it gives the linebacker level some choices in terms of who they throw out there, some versatility depending on the type of offense that they're going against, and the ability to rotate, which will be nice. So that's been a big emergence, and I don't see McGrone going back to the bench, even if Josh Ross is healthy. McGrone's just been playing too well, and to be honest, Ross was not having a great season before he got hurt. This one from at NDDub. What is the thing you look for to deeply analyze football while watching? Like in basketball, it's always don't follow the ball while watching, and you learn so much about the game. Is there a football equivalent? Trying to be more knowledge as a football viewer. Thanks. It's a pretty similar thing with football in terms of taking your eye off the ball is really the biggest key to understanding. And actually, I think it's easier to do this than it is for basketball, because in basketball, what happens with the ball really matters. And the pace of play is so high that you don't get a second look at a lot of plays. So there's a lot of stuff. I find it harder personally to pull my eye off the ball in a basketball game than I do when I am watching football, even live. For football, there are two different places I tend to watch when I am watching a game, kind of in analysis mode. And at this point, it's kind of just become how I watch games anyway. Because the thing is with football, the offensive line, by and large, is telling you what's going to happen. RPOs have, run pass options have made this a little bit tougher, but in general, after the snap, if those guys are firing out and trying to move the defensive lineman off the ball, you're getting to see a run play set up, and you're also getting to see holes open up. You're getting to see how aggressive the defensive front is, how many guys they're sending, if there's a free runner coming through. You can pick up a lot. You can learn pretty easily whether an offense is running gap blocking schemes, zone blocking schemes, power stuff, zones. You can get a feel for kind of if an offense is switching things up, if they're generally running things that look the same, even if you don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of you know, football plays and strategy, you can still get a lot just by seeing, you know, is the offensive line moving the defensive line, or is it happening the other way around? Are there free guys getting through? You can kind of you can often see whether the running back is picking the correct hole. And there's a lot of stuff, and you have the knowledge in football of, okay, if I watch the offensive line on this play, yes, I may miss a move in the backfield or something, but 95% of the time, if something exciting happens that the quarter with the quarterback or running back, you're going to get a replay of it. So, and usually, you know, you start out by watching the line, and then, you know, if they go into a pass shell, your eyes kind of either drift to the secondary, or maybe you watch the quarterback a little bit, see where his eyes are going. But if it's a running play, you know, the back's going to appear, and then you can kind of just follow him from wherever he shows up, sort of in your viewing picture. And then, depending on the situation, the other spot I like to look at is just right into the back seven of the defense, just to see what kind of coverage they're running, see if you can see any receivers pop open, you know, try to see what the quarterback is looking at. The trouble with that is that most television broadcasters are not doing a great job of showing what's happening down the field. So for this, it's definitely easier to zero in on that offensive line. And I mean, everything, as Michigan fans should know pretty well right now, everything kind of stems out from how well those guys do. So you can learn a lot from just watching both the offensive and defensive front, seeing how they're attacking each other, how they're switching things up, you know, seeing if the offensive line is able to pick up stunts, if the defensive line is running those stunts, how often is the defensive line switching up personnel? Is there a particular matchup up front that a team is attacking and taking advantage of? But you'll get a, when you start doing that, you'll see that a lot of stuff that's usually credited to running backs or quarterbacks really should be chalked up to line play. And a lot of times the same goes for the defensive side of the ball too. All right, got a similar question for basketball from at Go Dayton Flyers. Any reading materials or websites you recommend to better understand basketball from an analytical and play-by-play standpoint? One I would very much like to point out that we've highlighted on the site, Hoop Vision's Twitter account. Hoop Vision also has a newsletter that I have found remarkably valuable. There's a free version and a subscriber version. I'm only on the subscriber version right now, or the free version right now, and I think they just unveiled the premium version. But what they've put in there is like coaches level breakdowns. One of their recent emails was a lengthy breakdown on what defenses produce what types of shots, and I found that, for example, elite man-to-man defenses are high-pressure man-to-man defenses are great at forcing isolation possessions, which are, you know, less efficient, especially at the college level, than most other types of plays. Meanwhile, gap defenses like Wisconsin's are really, really good at limiting passes to cutters. So you've got some kind of, but they do that at the sacrifice of turnovers, whereas a lot of those more high-pressure man-to-man defenses will force more turnovers with the trade-off of giving up some of those cuts. We've also got breakdowns in individual defense. You know, it's a really impressive mix of kind of over like big picture strategic stuff and also like technical coaching points. So I've learned a lot just from signing up for that mailing list over the summer. They are at hoopvision.substack.com. A free one's been great so far. We'll see what changes with the subscription version as we hit college basketball season soon. But at the very least, their archives are up and very much worth scrolling through. You can learn a lot from those. Next question is from @Buster from JP. What's the most important recruiting battle for Juwan Howard, as in the biggest need over the next 3 years? Or do you think the key is just getting the first top American recruit? I think the biggest thing here is just to get one in. I'd think if you kind of had to pick a guy right now that they're in on, I would maybe go with Namari Burnett, just because he's the five-star that was connected with the previous coaching staff, then had even longer standing connections with Juwan Howard when Howard came in. Michigan doesn't have as much blue blood competition there. So I think winning that recruitment would be a very good sign, because if Michigan isn't going to be regularly picking off guys from Duke and Kentucky while going after players from that five-star tier, then you want to make sure they're at least hitting on the guys that are just a cut below that, where the competition may not be quite as stiff and not as much of a well-oiled recruiting machine. Positional needs, it's going to be pretty much everything as the roster turns over the next 3 years. So I think the biggest thing is just to get your first five-star in and see how many more follow, because you do very much ride momentum with recruiting, and a lot of times guys like teaming up with each other, and I think as it often does with basketball recruiting, I think the dominoes will start falling with some speed once you get the first one tipped over. From @RighteousRob1, what band name appropriately fits this Michigan team? I already used it as the title of a podcast. It's We Were Promised Jetpacks. We were promised jetpacks. We have not been given jetpacks. Last one, a little bit off topic, but this one's from @DavidYCook1. What is your meal of choice on game day? I've typically dished up a steak for the first game of the season, followed by chicken wings for the rest of the season. I wish I had a good answer to this, but I eat like garbage on game days. I think I got very used to having a press box buffet up there that kind of just took care of that need for me. But since I've been covering games from home, I'm usually so busy prepping for the game that I don't do a great job with breakfast. And most days I'm not a big breakfast guy anyway. And then once I'm into it on game day, I'm either finding something frozen to just heat up real quickly at like halftime, or usually what I end up doing is making an excessively large delivery order that covers both lunch and dinner, so that I don't have to think about food for the rest of the day, and I can just write and watch football and not think about cooking or cleaning up or having to plan for a meal. Instead, I am much more likely to get just like a bunch of Mediterranean food or a bunch of Chinese food, or a couple of pizzas, and just, graze throughout the day. But I haven't developed a routine yet. I haven't developed some sort of ritual for game days. I know a lot of people have them, but at this point, for me, it's grab whatever's closest and get back to taking notes. So that's sort of my game day. But maybe I'll come up with something later. Anyway, that's been the pod for this week. Thank you to everybody who wrote in. I appreciate your questions. And I'll be back next week with hopefully a happy breakdown of the Illinois game, answering your questions from that, and probably getting into more basketball stuff as we get closer. I know I keep saying that and not doing it, but I'm running out of time for not doing it. So if you want to get more basketball-centric stuff in, hit me up on Twitter @AceAnBender. Tag them with the hashtag @AcePod so I don't have to scroll through all my mentions to find everything. Or email me ace@mcoblog.com. And obviously, mailbag is going to be a staple of this podcast. So if you want to just get those in whenever, you don't have to wait for me to put out the call on Twitter. So yeah, we'll hear from y'all next week, and hopefully I'll have some good answers.